This is the Yale University Press podcast. I'm Claire Barnes, one of the hosts of the podcast, covering our books on the environment, politics, religion, history, law, and biography. I'm excited to welcome our guest today, award-winning classicist Edith Hall. Edith Hall is a professor in the Department of Classics and Ancient History at Durham University. She is the author of more than 30 books, including Aristotle's Way, How Ancient Wisdom Can Change Your Life. Today, we're here to talk about Edith Hall's recent book with Yale University Press, Facing Down the Furies, Suicide, the Ancient Greeks, and Me. Welcome, Edith, to the podcast.
Hello, I'm delighted to be here.
I think this will be a really interesting discussion on the intersection of ancestral suicide and the classics, and I'm looking forward to delving in further. But first, Edith, I'd like you to tell our listeners about how you developed your love for the classics and the Greek language. Where did it all begin?
Well, thank you very much. My family, my father and my brother had both studied classics at university, so it was in some ways rather expected of me. I didn't really enjoy Latin at school. But I fell madly in love with Greek from the first day that I saw a page of it. And I was incredibly lucky to get access to these ancient languages because in the state school system in Britain, so parents who don't pay fees, and that's 93% of teenagers, they're just not available. But way back when, in the 1970s, the early 1970s, there was still a system in place called the 11 plus examination, which meant all the nation's children were examined at 11 and 25% of them were selected supposedly on merit, intellectual merit, and sent off free to private schools. And that's what happened to me. And I went along to Nottingham Girls High School and I did some Latin and then I started Greek. And the very first text that we actually read as a text was a Greek tragedy called Iphigenia and Aulis. And I felt absolutely transported. I couldn't believe this. It spoke to me like nothing had ever spoken to before. No fairy tales or Disney movies. And I was riveted right there.
And you also talk about in the book this award-winning essay that you submitted in a competition at the Girls Public Day School Trust on Chorus in Greek Tragedy, which I thought was really a really charming story that exemplified your love for the Greek language.
Yes. I mean, I didn't realize I was doing anything unusual, but I was so taken with this terrible play about basically a murder in a family and the falling out of two parents and its repercussions that I went off and scrambled around charity shops and got the cheapest copies in English, any old translations of the other 29 surviving Greek tragedies. And I just read them all, I devoured them. As I said, I didn't think this was particularly unusual for a 16-year-old girl. So there was an essay competition run. The school I was at was part of a consortium, a national consortium of 20 or 30 girls' schools. And there was a prize for the best essay in classics. And I just wrote what I thought about the Greek chorus across all these plays. Thought no more about it. And lo and behold, I got this prize. And I always remember my extremely straight-laced, unmarried and pedantic classics teacher beaming. The one and only time I remember her beaming was when she announced this and she read out the judges' comments and they said, "We do not understand how this girl has read all of Greek Tragedy," and produced an argument. Now, for the life of me, I can't remember what that argument was. Maybe somewhere in the, you know, office deep down of the Girls Public Day School Trust, there's a filing cabinet with it in, but I have no idea what I said. But that's indicative of how odd I was, I think, that I developed a passion for something. I didn't tell anybody about it. I just went off and scratched my itch and spent all my very small pocket money on cheap secondhand editions.
It'd be really interesting to see if there is a copy surviving somewhere and how it compares to some of your recent work, which I want to turn to now. In Aristotle's Way, you briefly respond to questions about suicide, But you say that this book illuminated what you still needed to confront. Tell us about how Facing Down the Furies comes from this need in your previous work.
That book was about a very important aspect of my life, which is how I really got myself out of teenage and young adult angst that was much like everybody else's, I think. But my solution was to start practicing the kind of way of life that aims at trying to make the best possible version of yourself, working on yourself ethically and emotionally, which is exactly what is prescribed by Aristotle. And 40 years later, I wrote that book and tried to apply it to very practical situations, very female often, you know, that had arisen in my life as much as a mother and a wife and a daughter as anything. But I definitely skated over the fact that I did say I'd had a very traumatic young adulthood. I didn't say why or how. And people wrote to me who've read that book and found it very helpful, but said, you do not say what to do if you're suffering from, you know, medical, clinical level depression that will not go away. And I felt really quite guilty and shocked at myself because I have suffered from medical, clinical level depression. I've had several nervous breakdowns. And I really felt that I was sort of letting my readership down, if you see what I mean. I think I just said, look, if you're feeling that bad in that book, go to your doctor and get some SSRIs, antidepressants. You know, I can't go there. Doing Aristotle's ethics requires concentration, a certain level of optimism, a certain commitment to the project, all of which you're quite incapable of if you can't get out of the bed in the morning to clean your teeth. And I have been there. So I decided to that I ought to try and write a book about depression. There are many philosophers who've written about it. But then my mother died in 2016. And a few years after that, and I talk about it in the book, actually not till 2021, I got hold of a large box of papers, which told me a lot about her mother and her great-grandfather and her great-great-grandfather and mother that I had never known because she would not talk about them. And this is the family that had the endogenous depression. So I decided to go on a journey. They were all in Scotland, they're Scots, to find out more about them. And in the course of that journey, which I took in July 2022, I realised it came to me that my whole life had been, you know, I spent my whole life specialising in Greek tragedy, that this was some sort of response to the vibes I was getting from my mother, the silent vibes of total misery about coming from a family with such repeated violent deaths. And I do call suicide a violent death. Just because it's turned on yourself doesn't mean it's not an act of violence. And I it really came to me very quickly. I wrote the book in about 4 weeks immediately after I came back. It just all gelled. And I have to say, can I compliment Yale University Press? It was obviously a very personal book. I talk about incredibly personal matters and family secrets and my own psychotherapeutic past. And I trusted Heather Gold. I had been in touch with the Classics commissioning editor over another book, which is yet to come out. And she just said she stayed up all night crying over this thing, but also finding it very redemptive, and she would love to publish it. And because I trusted her personally, so I have to compliment you, your press. This is the editor. If you've got, you need discretion and sensitivity.
Heather Gold is really an amazing editor, and I've had, you know, yeah, multiple authors credit her, which is a testament. Yes. And I'm interested in kind of another, you know, classical female figure, which is in the title, The Furies. And I want to talk a little bit more about the title of the book. When I was reading, you mentioned and I had noted that the Furies are representatives of the genre of tragedy, and so really a fitting motif for this narrative. But for those who really aren't familiar with the form that the Furies take, tell us more about them and the choice to include the phrase facing down the Furies in the title.
The Furies, the actual Greek word is Erinyes, which is sort of connected with the word for strife or conflict. But these are how the ancient Greeks from centuries before the tragedians, all the guys I'm writing about were in the 5th century BCE. For centuries before that, the Greeks had imagined that the spirits of those of the unjustly or violently dead, you know, restless spirits whose deaths hadn't been avenged or whose problems had not been resolved, live in the underworld. They're dark, frightening females. They take different forms. We've got many, many vase depictions of them. And I cite an article in the book where you could go and look up the pictures. And what they do is that they pursue those left living against whom the dead person has got either a huge grudge, especially if they were murdered, you know, the actual murderer, or just unresolved business. And there are some plays, for example, Orestes kills his mother. And in Aeschylus's great trilogy, the Oresteia, the final chorus is of the Furies of his mother. They pursue you, they turn you mad, they torture you mentally, and the Greeks also thought sort of physically, that they often have snakes that bite you or brands to brand you with. But really, it's a very physical manifestation of mental disturbance that people get when they have unresolved stuff with the dead. And Cicero already saw that as a Roman. He actually said the Furies are a sort of externalization of our internal emotions. But of course, post-Freud, this makes absolute sense. We can't escape from our pasts. You know, if some adult dies that we had any kind of dependence on or relationship with, and we can't figure out how they died, or we feel guilty about how they died, or we can't accept the misery they were in if it was suicide, you know, just unresolved stuff of any kind, then the Furies pursue us. And other people have used that figure. Winston Churchill suffered from endogenous depression and he called it his black dog. And the Erinyes are often likened to dogs on the chase. They make noises like a dog who smelt a rabbit and is racing across the field, that yelping noise. They're quite canine. They also have wings sometimes. I mean, they're different animals. So because I had been reading Greek tragedy since I was 16, I quite often imagine my depressive attacks, because it does feel like an attack from outside, as being attacked by the Furies. But I also realise, and this will come out in this talk, that you know that the person in my family who was the true heroine was my mother. My mother had a really catastrophic childhood and had to deal with a very long history of suicide in the family, and she didn't give in to it. She faced down the Furies. And that phrase just came into my head at some point. Mum, you faced them down. I'm going to cry in a minute, actually, and this may happen a little in this podcast. She's dead, her mother's and her grandfather's and several other Furies full in the face, and she carried on living, had a large family, had some happiness, and died a natural death at the age of 90. So this is in part a real love song to her, even though she did visit a lot of it on me, and I suffered the legacy. So they are the ancestral Furies, and it goes on for generations if you don't come to a resolution. And I think my mother found the way to just face them down and say they do not have to dominate my new family. So I hope that's a redemptive. I hope the book, I mean, it's pretty depressing at times, but I hope it's ultimately redemptive. Here I am, you know, she died at 90. Here I am. I was 65 on Monday. And despite some serious suicidal thoughts in my life and one real near miss, I'm right here. I brought up 3 children and I'm a very happy woman. So I hope this message, if people read it who are either in that state themselves or carers of people in that state, will also see it as a redemptive thing that you can get out of this.
And in the book, you make really interesting connections between your own memory of your mother and your dreams, and then kind of in this redemptive arc, you talk a lot about how she has changed even in the afterlife to you, for you. And you connect that to family curses in Greek tragedy.
Yeah.
And I know that, I mean, after reading the book, it's very clear to me how Greek tragedies can speak to modern audiences, especially those who are afflicted with suicidal urges themselves. But you write also that, you know, the Greeks are particularly positioned to do this.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Why is that so?
I didn't realize this when I was studying Greek tragedy earlier in my life. But once this idea of this book started to form in my head, I realized how precious, and until very recently, I've dated it in the book till about the 1990s, at least, and almost the millennium, we do not have art and literature that really investigates the impact of suicide on those left behind. Almost all the discourse in literature and art is obsessed with the suicidal individual. He's usually male. Okay, Virginia Woolf's a bit of an exception there, but they're usually male. And they've got this philosophical, and they have existential crises. Nobody writes in any depth about what it feels like to be bereaved by suicide. And the psychologists I've read about all of this, and there's some really wonderful ones in California and in New York, who studied the long-term effects, you know, transgenerationally, not just on the children of those who kill themselves, but visited down two or three generations of one of these deaths. So, but the Greek tragedians in the 5th century wrote numerous plays which focus almost entirely on those left behind. They're right there. And it's incredible. Now, the reason this all sort of went underground is basically Christianity. It's not just Christianity, the other monotheistic faiths, and indeed Confucianism in China, all ban suicide. You know, it's a very strong thing, but they ban it for religious reasons, right? So God says, no, you're not entitled to take your life. You are God's creation. You can't go around choosing when you die. If you're suffering, it's because you've deserved it. You know, there's all kinds of arguments. So it was prescribed, banned. And that did not start to be questioned until the 18th century Enlightenment. Because if you questioned it, you were actually being heretical. I mean, you might end up getting in serious trouble for not being a properly religious person in my tradition, Christian. So nobody wanted to write anything about it. I mean, you've got lots of Jacobean revenge tragedies and things, and people kill themselves, but they get, you know, the plays end. They get their comeuppance. There's punishment. They go to hell because they committed suicide. It's not until the 1990s, in a new secular and kinder age, where some playwrights and memoirists started to write what it was like to have a mother who killed herself, or what is it like. So we have some now, but for, as I said, more than 2,000 years, the only texts that did that were these Greek plays. And so my pre-existing belief that they're some of the greatest pieces of literature in world culture, which I really do believe, became enlarged to incorporate the idea that they're the perfect texts for, I think, actual work in practical therapy. That is one of the things I want to see done, is that people read these plays in to deal with depression. I would like to see them done in reading groups. I'd like to see drama companies do them, and then have people talking about their own memories and feelings. I do think they've got therapeutic potential in collective arenas, but this book is just therapeutic, I hope. I tell you the stories, I tell you the speeches of the sufferers, and quite a few of them have quite upbeat endings, right? Especially the last one I discuss in detail, which is the one that saved my life. That's Heracles Mad by Euripides, where Heracles is talked down when he has more reason to want to die than almost anybody ever has in his history, because he's killed all of his children and his wife, in a fit of delusion, a psychotic fit, and he comes around. Who would want to go on living after unintentionally killing? Right. And he is talked down, and it's half the play is his best friend, not a relation, and his adoptive father, because his actual biological father is Zeus, his adoptive human father, said that neither of them are blood relations. They just love him. And they do everything right. And what they actually say to him to persuade him, to dissuade him from suicide, I think is should be studied by, you know, everybody whoever has to deal with anything like this issue. And it's a play that's hardly ever performed. Perhaps it's too shocking for that reason. I don't know. I want to see it performed by psychotherapeutically sensitive theatre professionals. Mm.
That's a really interesting application of the classics to modern day psychology. And I want to talk a little bit more about that at the end of the podcast. But as you've kind of explored, you don't only look at Greek art and literature in the book, but philosophies of David Hume and Albert Camus, to name a few. And some of these philosophers have philosophical justifications for suicide. Can you tell us why you find them unconvincing and maybe would be more in favor of something like Camus' reading of Sisyphus?
Since, I suppose, it's the late Renaissance, early modern period, a very few brave voices began to say, look, this is awfully harsh, just assuming that anybody who's been so miserable that they killed themselves is automatically going to suffer in hell. So one of the very earliest defences is actually theological, and that is that maybe the split second between taking the poison or loading the gun, people sort of repented somehow and said sorry to God, and that allowance would have been made. The 18th century Enlightenment situated it more in terms of personal liberty, rights of man, that we've all got that autonomous right. And that's as the grip of really bigoted Christianity started to loosen. So some of the great French Enlightenment writers like Diderot started to say, look, it's fine. we've all got a right to end our lives when we want to. It's our life. It's a natural liberty. Then you had a sort of romantic cult of the lone poet, the great creative artist who's full of angst and is suffering incredible poverty because his art isn't accepted. And there's a great vogue for that from, it's a romantic period. It's from Goethe through to about the 1830s or 1840s. And then finally, the fourth justification comes in with French existentialism, right? So this is irreligious, but especially Jean-Paul Sartre, the idea that our existence is completely meaningless and absurd, and it is. I would actually agree with that, because we don't know why we're here. Nobody does. And we don't talk about it enough, right? It's all we can talk about is how we respond to it. And Sartre and a lot of the others, there's a lot of French movies about suicide in the 50s and 60s, and they all centre on a very complex and interesting male individual. And he goes around looking at the world, feeling alienated, and then jumps off something. But those don't look at the people left behind. They're all by men. And as I point out in this book, Hume, you know, had no family. It's all very well for him. saying this, quite a few of the Rousseau, you know, had several children, but they were all put in an orphanage. He didn't look after them. It's actually deeply irresponsible, and is fine if lone male hermits really think that nobody else will be affected. But actually, Immanuel Kant said that there is no possibility of nobody being affected. Even the most solitary individual, someone has got to find them, right? Somebody has got to clear up the mess. And both hotel staff in Britain, both hotel staff and railway workers are trained, because that sooner or later they go into a hotel room and someone has killed themselves, or sooner or later they're a train driver who kills someone. I was actually on a train that did that just the other day, and the train driver was so disturbed, you know, he it obviously didn't carry on, but we were told that he'd had to go straight into psychiatric unit, right? So what we have to think about is those left behind, and that's what this book is all about. It doesn't mean I feel callous about suicidal people. I've been suicidal. We have to do everything in our power to prevent suicide. We need far more resources committed to that. And we need far more sensitivity, actually, especially in the cases of the most vulnerable groups, who are single middle-aged men. That is the most, you can actually statistically show that, especially ones who've been divorced, who've lost a family, that and have absolutely nobody to talk to. So we need that. But my book is not about that. There are many, 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 many books about that. I wanted to write a book about the bereaved by suicide.
In discussing your great-grandfather's death, you recall Sophocles' Ajax, and this is a man who's totally unconvinced by his consort or by his wife to not commit suicide, and out of humiliation and shame. I wanted to see if you could kind of talk more about this connection, especially in your own personal story.
So my grandfather was a great-grandfather, Robert Masterton, was a man from a very, very deprived child labour background, who had risen on his wits. He was highly intelligent, transcended this very impoverished background, working class background in a factory in Scotland, and risen up the ranks and eventually became one of the most prominent people in his local town, which was a very successful, prosperous town on the east coast of Scotland called Dunbar, married the mayor's daughter, my great-grandmother, and for nearly 30 years rose in the ranks and became basically, after his father-in-law, the most prominent citizen in this town, and worked for the council and made quite a lot of money, had four children, ostensibly had made a huge success of his life. But for reasons I tried to uncover, and I went and did all the research, he, in his late 50s, simply went out one day and drowned himself. And the whole community said they were in shock. But when I read all the sermons and the reports, it turns out that he had been exhibiting acute signs of distress for some time. Heavy drinking, weird scenes in the streets, getting into fights on the council. He was clerk to the council. Getting into fights, he was a good churchman. Or, you know, there were lots of distress signals. And yet he deceived people. The day that he died, he appeared to be perfectly normal. He went around doing his normal day's work. He was seen, and he just quietly, secretly, and on his own went off and drowned himself. And this is, to me, like the archetypal crime in the family, though I do now suspect his mother killed herself. As I think I said, I suspect that quite strongly, because she died quite young after losing six of her 12 children. And in Scotland, they don't put suicide on the, they don't have to. It's a different legal system. So I actually think it goes back further. But he had exhibited absolutely every sign of distress. This is exactly like Ajax. So Ajax in the play, and the suicides are very similar. They take place on a beach, you know, summer night on a beach. The family has been pushed away, the wife and children, and indeed siblings. And Ajax actually tells everybody, because he's had a psychotic fit and he's humiliated himself acutely, very much so. And he's been looked down on by his own side. He's been humiliated by his own generals in the Greek side, Agamemnon and Menelaus and Odysseus. And I found out that my great-grandfather almost certainly had as well. He hadn't got to be mayor. But Ajax tells everybody he is going to kill himself. They all say, oh, no, don't do that. So what he does is he says, oh, no, I was wrong. I'm fine. Let's just go back to my island, Salamis. Off of that. We're just going to leave. Come on, wife and child. You know, I'm going to stick it out. Well, you know, they say, oh, phew. And leave him on his own. And the minute they stop looking after him, he goes out on the beach and stabs himself to death. And the second half of the play is about their distress. And they do all say, we should have known. And his own men, the chorus is his own regiment. They all say, we shouldn't have left him on there. So that play actually, though it's depressing, ends up giving us a very great secret. Sophocles knew about proud middle-aged men who deceive people in order to get an opportunity to kill themselves. And that is a very, very common thing that happens. I was thinking about A Star Is Born. I don't know if you've seen the remake of A Star Is Born with Bradley Cooper. That's exactly what he does. It's exactly what he does. And the film very clearly shows you how he deceives everyone so he could get the opportunity. And I found that scene for me, because I replayed my grandfather's death. But as I say, the play has a redemptive quality in it. First, it shows just how much suffering he's going to inflict. And that argument in practice can help a lot of suicidal people not commit suicide. They do love people. And if you can persuade them of the degree of misery they're going to inflict, that was the argument that always stopped me. But it also has this unique psychological insight about the lying, the deceit, in exactly the profile of the middle-aged man. He's very closed off. He can't emote. He can't ask for help. So that play is invaluable, and it helped me come to terms with my great grandfather's death. And for me, a lot of the redemption was simply going to the seaside pond where he'd done it. That was when all my bad dreams started to go away. I went and said goodbye. I'd never knew him. You know, this was in 1912, but it affected my grandmother terribly. She was a student at Edinburgh University. She eventually killed herself, which affected my mother terribly. I remember that happening, and it affected me vicariously, not as terribly, obviously, but it has dominated my whole life that my grandmother, after whom I was named, killed herself. So it's always felt like a ready possibility if things got a bit tough. So that's that play. Mm-hmm.
I think there's such resonance with the gender dynamics in both the play as well as in your own life, especially the women who are left behind. And thinking about the psychological impact of that. Boy.
Yeah, he has this little boy. I mean, his little boy has to go and find his father stabbed himself to death on the beach. It's heartbreaking.
And that's not to say that women don't commit suicide in ancient Greek tragedies at all. But, you know, as you note, many of those who have committed suicide have great impact on those who are left behind. But you mentioned that they're often not recorded as suicides, or those who commit suicide are not afforded the same burial rights, not afforded headstones.
That has absolutely historically been the case. For the ancient Greeks, it was nothing like not being afforded a burial. It really wasn't. They were much more humane from that point of view. But Aristotle, who considers suicide and asks the great question, who is wronged by it? He's trying to work, you know, what is it that it does? And he's the first person ever to just say, look, who is actually really damaged by it? It can't be the person who's dead, because they're dead. So who, and he doesn't believe in this Christian stuff about afterlives and things. So who is it? So he says it's the community. But in Aristotle, the state, the community, is built out of a number of houses. He sees you haven't got the right, if you're a member of a community, to murder a member of the community. He's quite upfront that it's a murdering a citizen. Okay. He doesn't talk much about wives and children and husbands and fathers and mothers. That's the Greek tragedians who do that. But the Christians... routinely for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And in fact, it was still the law until the early 19th century that the body should not be, should be cast out. Often things like impaled through the heart to stop it, the spirit rising. Even in Christian culture, sort of really strange pagan ideas persisted. Mutilation, hands chopped off, had done the crime. in ancient Greece, there was certainly a sense of pollution that you had to cleanse and and purify where it had happened. So my grandfather was not, he had a church service, but nobody knows. His body certainly wasn't buried on sacred ground. I suspect they buried him close to that pond, but I don't know. So he was absolutely denied. His body was still in 1912 regarded as couldn't be anywhere near the corpses of the righteous. And that's pretty shocking that that's only 110 years ago. They still had the right in the law in Scotland, they had the right also to remove all his property. But that had actually ceased to be carried out in practice in the early 19th century. But that meant that for many, many hundreds of years, say a widow of a man who'd killed himself didn't just face social shame and disgrace because he'd committed a crime against God, was unable to bury him properly, faced unbelievable shame and taboo, but also financial desperation, because you'd lose the property. So it's, I'm really surprised no one has written this book before. that's what really came through to me, was this miserable history of already miserable people being made to feel even more miserable by the social stigma surrounding this most tragic of human eventualities. Mm.
Can you tell us more about some of the physical elements or clues that you use to piece together some of your own family history?
Yes, various things. So both my mother and my grandmother were great needlewomen. And I've put pictures of two of their great artworks in the book. And they both revealed incredible secrets to me, why they embroidered those particular scenes. In particular, there's a beautiful silk embroidery by Edith, my grandmother, of a woman grieving at a tomb. And I never knew what it was till I got it from my mother's house only 2 years ago. And it's a portrait of Lotte, Carlotta, in Goethe's Sorrows of the Young Werther, which was one of the biggest, bestsellers of the late 18th century, translated into numerous languages, which is all about how a young man who's in love with a married woman, can't have her, and eventually shoots himself. And Carlotta, at the end of the novel, it's left dot, dot, dot. It says her life was despaired of. What does that mean? Does Goethe mean she went and killed herself? She has children. She has husband. And I found, when I got it, I looked, there was an inscription on the tomb in the embroidery, and it said Werther. And I realised that my grandmother, who had suffered from this terrible loss of her father by suicide, and she adored him. And she was by far the cleverest child, and he'd imposed a lot of expectations on her. She had spent what must have been a year embroidering Carlotta mourning at Werther's tomb. However, the upbeat one is that, for reasons I don't know, my mother had said I was to have this magnificent, it's more than a metre long and a metre wide tapestry of Saint Cecilia, the patron saint of music, singing joyfully with her husband and children in a meadow. And I realised, I'm going to cry, I'm sorry. I realised after going on this long journey that she was telling me to, keep on singing. Keep on singing. She was a great singer. She was an expert. Not professional or semi-professional, but she was as good as a professional. And I think singing saved her. She got all her best friends through being in amateur opera groups. She loved it. She met my father through singing Scottish country music. So I sort of realised after this great journey why, because I'm the only child of her four who has had psychiatric problems, depressive ones. And so going on this journey helped me literally unravel the stitches of these two images. There were also some other things, including a book my mother gave me when I got my first, in England, it's a big deal when you get a professorship. This means the chair. It means like the head of a department. And I got it quite early for a woman. I was only 40. And she gave me a copy of one of her mother's textbooks from her days at university. She studied English and Latin. And I studied English and classics and had been a professor of both. And my grandmother had written a very sad poem out in it, but she'd also read all of Aristotle's Poetics. And actually, a text I'm about to edit, I'm doing a commentary on it and underlined all the bit. And I felt this was just electrifying. I was reading the same text on literature as my namesake grandmother. And it formed an incredible bond. And again, my mother had decided to give me that. Now, that's sort of questionable because she told me far too often, I can't be entirely positive about her, how like her mother I was. That is not a good thing to tell a child when your parent is committing suicide, that you are just like them. I know I even look like her. You can see it in the pictures in the book. And she was apparently very funny. She was very articulate. She was very theatrical. She loved theatre. She loved everything I loved. She even loved going to football. I watch soccer, right? It's really, really strange. And I know I look like her and I'm the only dark one. My siblings are all blonde. But giving me that book did actually help me because it showed me that my grandmother had for many years of her life, she'd had a very, very alive brain and it had been satisfied. She had a satisfied mind reading exactly the stuff I do. So that was a comfort. There are other things, there are other objects in the book as well. But I think that's also very female, isn't it? It's like stuff, domestic stuff that you've got in the house. I've inherited my mother's baking equipment because some of my happiest memories from childhood are her teaching me to bake. I don't hear men talking like that. That was like my mother's wooden spoon. So again, it's a very female thing. These objects are not, have no value financially, but electrifying physical bonds with these women.
The photos in the book, both of the pond and some of the places that you visited and the tapestries and your grandmother and university, are really, really do illuminate the story, and they're really wonderful additions to the book.
But one thing I felt about it is, you know, I used to read a lot of Trollope and sort of Thomas Hardy and fin de siècle social realist novelist, and a bit earlier, George Eliot, Elizabeth Gaskell, you know. And I uncovered in this whole world of fin de siècle and Edwardian Eastern Scotland, which is a very specific community, a combination of deeply enlightened, half of them are deeply enlightened descendants of David Hume, and half of them are completely fanatical Christians of one kind or another. And this small town bourgeois environment where these incredible electric tensions and conflicts and envies and career envy and murder and suicide. I mean, there really are all those things going on. And so I felt like I was almost stuck in a new novel. The actual territories are more like Walter Scott. I mean, he's the heart of Midlothian. This is East Lothian, but this is not Walter Scott. This is much more Trollope. It's petit bourgeois misery at that period of time. And I put in a lot of detail about that because I think some people will actually find that quite picaresque, if you like.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. And I know, I mean, we talked a little bit about where you ended your personal story in the book, although I don't want to give everything away, but how writing this book was a form of solace. And I'm wondering as we...
Hugely so.
And I'm wondering as we kind of come to the end of the podcast, what do you hope that readers will take away from your own family story, especially with all of these Greek tragedies interwoven into your narrative?
That this kind of miserable history can be got over, right? It's never too late. But that family silence about these things is absolutely pernicious. So I think this could have been arrested much, much earlier on, generations earlier on, if there weren't this taboo which my mother absolutely internalized. She was deeply ashamed and troubled by both her grandfather and her mother's suicide, couldn't find help, banned us talking about it, which meant there was this, I mean, the phrase is elephant in the room, but I call it the fury in the room. There was always the fury in the room. So what I would like this book to do is, in a small way, stimulate a much greater public debate about it. I'm happy to go out on any podcast, whatever, like this, and talk absolutely freely about what it feels like to be a 22-year-old suicidal woman, and for what reasons, and how I think we can help the young like that. And just to get everybody talking about it, we have to get rid of the stigma. And I think it still lingers. I think there's a fear. The Greeks called it miasma, pollution. They actually saw it physically. But I think there's a fear that it is contagious, because there are historically instances of whole rashes of suicide in educational establishments, for example. So there's a fear of contagion if we talk about it. But actually, not talking about it is much more likely to let that contagion take place. I'm absolutely convinced of this. So I actually tell people, even, you know, if I'm just stuck on train beside them for an hour or two, I get into the conversation that this, I am a second generation survivor of bereavement by suicide. Do you know, I've hardly met anyone whose eyes don't well up because there's one in their family and they weren't ever allowed to talk about it. I think it's far more common than is acknowledged. So, as I say, it seems to be quite extraordinary that nobody has written this book before.
Right. And as you mentioned a little earlier in the podcast, that Greek literature and art can help us uncover new things in therapeutic practice. And there really is a really important connection there, as you've talked about.
Really, well, the Greek philosophy really helps. I mean, we have this Aristotelian argument to build on. And in practice, it's now called the rights responsibilities argument, which is a long way of saying that if somebody is completely suicidal, one of the things you say is, well, there's lots of things that you say, like things can get better, things can look up. Just because you feel like this now doesn't mean like you'll feel like this in 10 years. We all love you. You are a valuable person. And we will look after you. But you can also say to them, how do you think your little child will feel? Or how do you think your mother will feel? Or even if they have no child or mother or students, and hardly anybody does, practically everybody's got workmates or neighbours who will find this hard. Even if they don't, it's what do you think the person who's got to clear you up is going to, who's completely blameless and uninvolved, is going to. So we've got that. But these therapeutic texts where every single kind of relation, fathers, mothers, children, husbands, siblings, servants, slaves, in the household slaves, the community, get to voice their pain in these plays. And that is what we really need to do, is allow people to voice their pain about it all before moving on to, now let's construct a future. Okay, so I always come back to this amazing choral line in Aeschylus's Agamemnon, which is from the same great trilogy as the Urania is in, which is sing the song of sorrow, but let good prevail. Sing the song of sorrow, but let good prevail. And that is just so powerful. We need to sing the song of sorrow. We need to share our pain over all these things. Both suicidal people need to talk about their pain, people who've been bereaved by suicide, as much as we need. But we have to stay optimistic that it can be avoided, it can be got through, it can be got over.
I think we've covered, you know, a lot in this conversation, and thank you for the thank you for the choral bookends. That was great. But, you know, is there anything else that we just haven't touched on that you'd like to share with our listeners about facing down the Furies?
Well, I think I talk quite a lot about external factors. What you can't divorce personal isolation and depression from historical circumstances. And in the case of my grandmother, there is no doubt whatsoever that the patriarchal structures she was living under thoroughly compounded her personal misery. You know, she felt she had to get married and she didn't have to get married. But in 1921, she had a degree, a brilliant degree, and was a successful school teacher. She did not have to get married to someone she didn't love, right? And then give up her job. It wasn't even a requirement at the school where she did. So I think her whole life could have been very, very different, not under patriarchy. And that comes through time and again. And I'm very, you know, she was a suffragette. She was out on the stumps in Edinburgh, the Women's Social and Political Union, before her father died, you know, so in around 1910. And she seems to have just lost any, I mean, she did get the vote by the Representation of the People Act 1918, because she was a property holding middle class woman, you know. But she lost some incredible sense of purpose because society told her she had to go and be a wife who didn't do anything all day. And of course, psychiatric treatments have improved massively. They certainly, you know, they have. We just have all these wonderful antidepressants that exist. But in case of the men, I mean, the horrific things that my ancestors suffered, my suicidal great uncle, who I haven't even talked about, but, you know, he had been completely traumatized as an army vet in World War II and used the same rifle that he used to shoot horses in Haifa, you know, on himself. And surely there should have been some sort of psychiatric help offered to anybody who'd been through that sort of thing in the Second World War. I think that was a completely avoidable death. So I think we have to contextualize these things about what people are up against. And I've really felt that post-COVID, because of course I was writing this just after, I mean, we only just got to Scotland in 2022. We were still having to wear masks in hotels and things like that. I think we have no idea yet what the psychiatric consequences of that weird time are going to be. And people were isolated in ways they never have been. Young people were deprived of some of the best years of their lives, you know, including my own daughters during their university years, you know. And many, many of my own students, I'm an academic, you know, far more are coming. The girls come with their psychic pain, the boys don't. So I think we're actually about to hit a huge tidal wave of psychiatric problems resulting from us all being confined in our houses for nearly 2 years. So we need to take that into account.
And I think this book is such a great narrative to read if anyone is facing that, and if anyone is coming out of this period looking for not only context, but inspiration as well. And I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us on this episode of the Yale University podcast. This has been a really enlightening and important discussion, and I encourage our listeners to grab a copy of Facing Down the Furies if they're interested in learning more.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor and a privilege and fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Facing Down the Furies, Suicide, the Ancient Greeks, and Me by Edith Hall is available wherever books are sold. Thank you so much for listening. Please visit us online at yalebooks.com for more episodes of the podcast, as well as information about all of our books.